featuring interviews and commentary from Animal Rights Zone, the online social network for humans who seek justice for other animals. You can find us on the web at www.arzone.net. I'm your host, Carolyn Bailey. Today's episode features special guest Mark Beekhoff. Professor Beekhoff and I will be joined by AR Zone admins Tim Geyer and Ronnie Lee. Mark Beekhoff is a former professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder and is a fellow of the Animal Behavior Society and a past Guggenheim Fellow. His main areas of research include animal behavior, cognitive ethology, which is the study of animal minds, and behavioral ecology. Mark has also published extensively on the need to change how humans regard, treat, and use other animals. Named to the advisory board of Green Vegans in 2010, Mark has served as an advisor or board member to numerous organizations throughout his career, including as co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Mark has published more than 300 essays, both scholarly and for mass media, and 22 books, including Species of Mind, The Philosophy and Biology of Cognitive Ethology with Colin Allen, and the Encyclopedia of Animal Rights and Animal Welfare. Professor Beekhoff has appeared on national and international television programs and has been published in major newspapers and magazines. He currently writes a popular column called Animal Emotions for Psychology Today. You'll find links to each of the articles mentioned in today's podcast at www.arzone.net. In 1986, Mark became the first American to win his age class at the Tour de Var bicycle race, which is also called the Masters or Age-Graded Tour de France. It's safe to say that Professor Beekhoff is a recognized expert in animal cognition and behavior and a trusted voice both inside and outside of the animal advocacy community. Mark, thank you for being here and welcome to AR Zone.
My pleasure to be here.
Mark, there's so much we could talk about today, but I'd like to begin by asking about your two new works due out in 2013, which are Rewilding Our Hearts and Ignoring Nature No More, The Case for Compassionate Conservation. Could you please speak a little about them and specifically about the two concepts of rewilding and compassionate conservation?
Yeah, thank you. These are projects that I've been working on for quite a while. The first project on compassionate conservation, really the ideas are being laid out in a book that will be published in around March of 2013 called Ignoring Nature No More, The Case for Compassionate Conservation. Compassionate conservation is a new movement. The first meeting was held in Oxford, England in September of 2010, and then we had another meeting in Chengdu, China in June of 2011 as part of the Asia for Animals meeting. And compassionate conservation is very simple. We want to bring together people who are concerned about individual well-being or welfare and individuals who work on conservation and environmental issues where the concentration is more on species, populations, and ecosystems. So it's sometimes a very difficult marriage, excuse me, but basically we're just trying to get people to focus on the individual animal. And, you know, so some of the questions in compassionate conservation would be, is it okay to trade off the life of one individual for the good of its species? So the best examples might be from the reintroduction program of wolves into Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming and Montana in the United States. So wolves were killed by humans. They were gone for give or take 70 to 75 years. And then we wolf-napped or kidnapped wolves from Canada, brought them back down into Yellowstone and released them. And in order that some of the wolves who were kidnapped and moved could live, some died. I helped on that project from time to time, and, you know, I just found that to be very disturbing, quite frankly. So basically the move is to have people, you know, like I said before, interested in animal protection, work with people who are working on environmental and conservation problems.
Thanks, Mark. It seems to me that some advocates for other animals can easily dismiss environmental and conservation issues as less significant and somehow disconnected to advocating for the rights of other individuals themselves. Could you please explain a little bit about what you see as the importance of the connection between our environment and the individual lives of others, particularly in regard to habitat destruction?
Well, yeah, I mean, this sounds kind of, you know, snitty, but one of the things that I do, because I do talk to a lot of conservation biologists, because I'm, you know, I am a biologist and I've done work on conservation, is I remind them, sometimes gently, sometimes it has to be a bit more forceful, I remind them that animals are part of the environment. And I mean, so when we're saving ecosystems or trying to recreate or restore ecosystems, we need to take into account the animals who live there. It's not just the plant life, for example. It also makes them think about how they do projects, you know. So, for example, with the wolf reintroduction, were there more humane ways to do this without losing wolves? It forces the issue, you know, like I said, that animals are part and parcel of the environment, and we are killing them by basically killing their habitats. To me, the exciting thing is, because I believe in animal protection, and I also believe that we do need to have some conservation efforts. For me, the exciting point right now is we're getting people with different agendas to talk to one another, and we're making some progress. You know, students are asking me how can they do a particular study more humanely, more ethically, that doesn't involve, you know, harming an animal. That's progress.
It's great to talk to you, because for a long time I argued that protection of the environment is an animal liberation issue. There are lots of animal liberation and animal protectionists that don't quite see that. But my first question is something a bit different to that, and I want to ask you how it was that you first became vegan and began campaigning for animal protection. What was it that that caused you to do that?
Well, I was campaigning for animals long before I was vegan. My parents tell me I was campaigning for animals when I was 3 years old, living in an apartment in Brooklyn, New York. And I say that really not lightly, because I wrote a book called Minding Animals that was published in 2002. And stories in there in the title came from a long talk I had with my parents when I was an adult. They said that I was always minding animals. I was always asking them what animals were thinking and feeling, and attributing minds to them, and also minding them and caring for them. A lot of, you know, different events that happened to me in education. I didn't dissect animals in high school. When I was a graduate student, I refused to partake in physiology labs. And then I was in a PhD MD program at a medical school that I quit because of, at the time, we had to do dog labs and cat labs and, you know, live animal vivisection. The move to vegetarianism and then veganism came after that, and it was just purely, you know, ethically based. I just, you know, maybe I woke up, I don't know. I mean, I never was a huge meat eater, frankly, but I woke up and just said, there's a disconnect here. And, oh, I stopped. I mean, seriously, it was nothing more than that. And I like to say that I went cold tofu, not cold turkey, because I just stopped overnight. You know, it wasn't any kind of transition.
That's brilliant, Mark. That's you know, great to hear about that. My next question is also related to veganism, and it's with reference to your victory in the Tour du Var uh-huh. Cycles. How important do you think it is for vegans to be fit and healthy in order to be better able to spread our message?
Right. Well, you know, the victory I had in the Tour du Var, I was still, I always, when people ask me, I would say I was a semi-vegetarian. I occasionally ate chicken. I occasionally ate a cheeseburger. The turn came about 4 years later, but I still won some very big bike races. I think, I don't know how to answer the question, you know, because I live in Boulder, Colorado, you know, which is a very healthy place, and I live with vegans and vegetarians and omnivores and carnivores. But I can tell you that there's a large contingent of people here and elsewhere who are vegan and vegetarian and who are, you know, very high-class athletes. And from my point of view, because I am very active, I think it's very compelling to people to know that there are, you know, vegan athletes of all different sorts and of all different skills. For example, when I race bikes, and I still race bikes, I wear socks that have PETA written on them. PETA used to make some socks. And that always stimulates a lot of discussion, sometimes during, you know, a long 50 or 100-mile road race, and afterwards people look at the socks and go, you know, some people go, oh, wow, you know, PETA, tell me more about it. Some people go, oh, you're one of those. But what comes from it is I can stress to them that, you know, as a vegan, I can still 500-mile races and rides and do quite well. And that intrigues them more than others. And just this year, one of my teammates, a woman who's a very competitive cyclist, one day we were out on a ride and she said, I'm vegetarian. And it wasn't like she was applauding herself and she wasn't, you know, doing anything self-congratulatory. But from talking with me, and she's a very, very good racer, she just decided one day, she said that she was, you know, rubbing her dog, and she just decided that she no longer wanted to eat animals. And so her rate, in many ways, and it could be a combination of factors, she's actually racing better than she ever raced in her life. So the message that you're, you know, the question you're asking and the message is that this woman is doing really, really well. And she went from being a moderate carnivore to being a vegetarian.
That's great, Mark. Thanks for that. The reason I often ask that question to people, it was because of somebody being a very healthy vegetarian that persuaded me to go vegetarian. So I understand myself the importance of that.
Right. I go out of my way. I actually, because I cycle, I used to run, but I really bike race now, bicycle race. I have a teammate who has been a vegetarian for 30-some-odd years and was on the national team, the national cycling team in America, back in the late 70s and early 80s as a vegetarian. And, you know, he's a strapping 6'3", you know, hunk, if you will. but there you go. So, no, I think your question is a really important one, Ron, because – you know, some people go, oh, well, if you're vegetarian or vegan, you can't be healthy. Or, you know, women shouldn't have babies, or, you know the story. And I'm thinking, well, it's just ridiculous. You know, look at all the carnivores who are singularly unhealthy.
I agree, Mark. I'd like to ask you a question about Jane Goodall's Roots and Shoots program, which yes, you're an ambassador of. And as part of that, you've spent a lot of time teaching animal behavior and conservation biology at a local county jail. Can you please speak a little bit about the program itself and also about the importance of teaching animal behavior in the prison system and how it's helped both you and your students?
Sure. Jane started a program called Roots and Shoots in the early 90s in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania with about 16 people. And it's exploded into an international organization. There's, I think she told me, I was with her a couple of months ago, I think there's give or take 90 countries that have Roots and Shoots groups, and there's thousands of Roots and Shoots groups in these 90 or so countries. The main mission of Roots and Shoots is to increase respect for animals, people, and the environment. APE, which spells ape, by the way.
Very good.
They're very activity-oriented. So I do work with young kids, old kids, college kids, high school kids. I've worked with senior citizens. I've had a man who was 100 years old in my class once at an assisted living center. And I do work in the Boulder County Jail with prisoners. And in fact, my latest Psychology Today essay, because I write regularly for them, talks about the work that I've done with them, and I can send that to you if you want. With the prisoners, we talk about animal behavior and conservation, and a lot of it's motivated by my work on the moral lives of animals and how animals are really much nicer to one another than the way they're depicted in the press. And, you know, the bottom line is when these guys get roughhousing and somebody says, oh, you're acting like an animal, I always say, oh, well, you just compliment them.
Yeah, that makes people think in itself, doesn't it?
Yes.
Absolutely. I think that from what I've heard of the work you're doing, I think it's outstanding. So, you know, thank you for doing that.
Yeah, thank you. It's been very rewarding. You know, when you've got a felony, I mean, the guys in my class range from, you know, pickpockets and drug dealers to multi-killers. And when you've got a felony, you can't get a job. Mm. But a couple have gone on when they've gotten out and started Roots and Shoots groups with their kids. And a couple of them have, you know, one became a dog groomer. I've got a guy who's working at the local car wash getting his degree, and he'd like to do work on conservation. So, and I just had an email from somebody who said it changed their lives. And, you know, I've been doing this for 12 years. I don't get paid to do it. And it's one of the happiest times of the week when I go, because these guys are really, not all of them, of course, but there's no more variation than in a university class. They're really gung-ho. And so it's a pleasure. And we talk a lot, you know, because, you know, they'll talk about animal rights. Some of them are hunters and, you know, they know I don't like hunting, but they're all against sport hunting. They're all against trophy hunting. I do a lot of work in China with Animals Asia and rescuing moon bears with Jill Robinson, and they write letters that I take to China with me when there's problems with wildlife being killed around here by the Division of Wildlife. They write letters. So they have a very active voice.
I think the essay that you might have been talking about, the Psychology Today one, Compassion Begets Compassion, I think that's quite a powerful statement, and I completely agree.
I appreciate this. When they let their hair down, and I've got essays, and we're going to get back to the rewilding idea. I've got essays from them, you know, about how being exposed to animal behavior and ideas about vegetarianism and veganism and animal rights and animal welfare has changed their lives. And the stories are very, very compelling. I had two guys come vegetarian as part of the class. You know, the bottom line, you all, is, and you know this as well as I do, is you never know where you're going to touch somebody. So you just put it out there, and you just hope people do something with the information. And sometimes we have heated discussions because I just don't like hunting. So we have discussions, and they're very civil with me because they know that I'm not just BSing to them.
Absolutely, yeah. So that would explain why you say that the ways that humans treat other animals are very important, but not only for the other animals, but also to our own well-being and psyche.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just speak a little bit about how we harm ourselves by harming others?
Well, I believe that, you know, there's this great power in the universe, and, you know, in some ways, it's almost like a karma, but I really believe that when we harm other animals and when we harm their homes, we harm ourselves, because we're all part of these great webs of nature, you know, these great webs of compassion. I mean, there can also be webs of harm and, you know, and killing. And so we're all part of this, you know, grand scheme of things, and that it hurts our souls when we hurt other animals. In all honesty, I don't have any proof for it, but even as a scientist, I don't need proof for talking about how important animals, non-human animals, are, you know, to us. So my view on that is a very spiritual view, but of course we know how helpful animals are in terms of helping people heal from diseases, providing camaraderie and companionship. And I always like to, you know, talk about how that relationship is reciprocal. that the animals, the dogs or cats or other animals, are getting a lot out of their interactions with us as we are getting from our interactions with them.
I agree with you. I think I've said before, I think kindness is very underrated. I think it's you know, a little bit more kindness from everyone would go a long way.
Yes. You know, this weekend I gave two lectures in a small mountain town in Colorado. They have a lecture series that actually brings in people from all over the world. And when we went out for dinner the first night, they knew I was vegan. You know, we went to a bar and, you know, I looked on the menu and the guy said, well, is there anything you can eat here, you know? And I said, well, sure, there's a mushroom burger, there's salad, there's pasta. And the point of that was he just had not really thought about it. And he's a great guy. So we got into a discussion. And then at the picnic they had for me after my last talk, two women brought veggie burgers. And so it's little moves, you know, where, you know, to do a song and dance about it, they, you know, and but I think you just put out the information and they watch you and then they either take it or leave it. I mean, there's nothing more you can say.
I agree. Absolutely. Doing a song and dance about it tends to turn people off.
Yeah.
In terrible ways sometimes. So, yeah, absolutely, I agree with you.
Mark, what's going to kind of changing a little bit? Whereabouts on the tree, in inverted commas, of evolution would you say that sentience begins? For instance, would you say that creatures like insects and earthworms are in any way aware or can feel pain?
You know, there's a lot of research being done that show that insects feel pain. I'm always leery about drawing lines, but, you know, we have to do it. And I think one of the ways that we convince other people that, you know, we're not just a bunch of nuts is to look at the science and look at what, you know, researchers are saying. So there's a lot of researchers who feel that insects feel pain. There's new work out that's just amazing on fish. There's a new book. A book was published in 2010 called Do Fish Feel Pain? And the woman who wrote it, Victoria Braithwaite, has no agenda on animal welfare or animal rights or animal protection, but her book conclusively shows that fish are sentient. They feel pain. They don't like being hooked in the mouth, et cetera, et cetera. So in terms of line drawing, I'd have to say that I'm always careful not to do it just because I don't want to shut out other animals who potentially will learn are sentient. And my answer to people who want a line drawing is that animals deserve respect regardless if they're sentient. They deserve respect because they exist as beings in the world. And, you know, as philosophers say, they have intrinsic and inherent value.
Mark, in referring to other animals, you wrote in a Psychology Today essay that you posted that you said it really doesn't matter if their consciousness is like ours, and that while other animals may or may not know who they are and may or may not have a sense of what I call I-ness, they do have a sense of bodiness and mindness. And you just spoke about being in the world. I'm wondering, can you explain what you mean by that difference between I-ness and body or mindness, please?
Yeah, I mean, what I mean by I-ness is that, you know, my dog Jethro, he may have known he was Jethro by associating come Jethro, and when he hears the word Jethro, he comes to me and I give him treats or, you know, tell him he's a good dog. But I don't know that he knows that he's Jethro like I know I'm Mark. So that's all I mean. You know, there's not a lot of evidence that non-human animals refer to themselves by name or by I. But there is, I think there's one or two observations that Coco the gorilla may have referred to himself or herself as I. So that's all I mean. What I mean by mindness is it's my body, it's my bone, it's my territory, it's not yours. And so they So that's a different, you know, level perhaps of self-awareness. I wrote a paper where we, this guy Paul Sherman and I talked about self-cognizance rather than self-awareness or self-consciousness, and then had different degrees of, say, self-cognizance. So that's all I mean. I, you know, once again, I'm not sure what the mirror studies, the red dot and, you know, the mirror studies that have been done with primates and elephants and dolphins, you know, I'm not sure what they really tell us when, you know, an animal is anesthetized, a red dot is put on, you know, their forehead, and then they touch it in the mirror. It may be, you know, that, well, you know, this is interesting and they touch it. It may mean something, you know, about self-awareness. I think it probably does mean something about self-awareness, but I don't really know where to, I frankly don't know where to go with it in terms of more than, you know, that there's a certain level of self.
Yeah. In an article that you wrote that was with Colin Allen, it was published in the Blackwell Companion to Consciousness. In that article, you two mention that there's two sorts of consciousness that really aren't at all debated. It's not controversial, but, you know, animals, just like human animals, all animals wake up and they go to sleep. And so that's one sort of consciousness. And then there's a sort of consciousness where we, all animals, perceive things in the world and act on those perceptions. But then there's consciousness that goes beyond that, and, you know, phenomenal consciousness or sentience is something that's beyond that, and there's access consciousness, and then there's self-consciousness, and I've read about affective consciousness, what has to do with emotions and so forth. So it really is a complicated question about what consciousness is. And so people will say, in the way that we anthropomorphize everything, people will say, well, bees engage in mating rituals, and they flee from threats. Why wouldn't we just assume that they're doing the same, you know, they think the same way that we would think in those circumstances? They're doing the same thing that we're doing. Why don't we take the simple solution and just say they're thinking just like us? But that's not really the simple solution, is it, when you look at it from a biological standpoint? If you're going to talk about, you know, parsimony and stuff like that, you can't assign them higher order consciousness like we think we have just based on their behaviors, can we?
Right. I mean, that's the, you know, right. That's a lucid, you know, discussion of what, you know, people have been talking about. Right. You can't just use behavior in and of itself, you know, as we develop techniques like magnetic resonance imaging for animals, and we see what parts of the brain are lighting up, that technique might provide a lot of really valuable insights into what's actually going on in their brain. It turns out that, you know, human animals can do many, if not most, of the things we do in a day without being self-reflective or really especially conscious. And so, and I think that's always important to point out. So, you know, we may have more highly evolved sense of self. We probably do, but, you know, it doesn't, once again, it doesn't mean that animals are less valuable or dumber than we are. What I like to say about consciousness and emotions is that it doesn't really matter if they're like ours, simply because animals do what they need to do to be pod-carrying members of their species. And so we know that, you know, New Caledonian crows, these phenomenally bright birds, can make and use more sophisticated tools than chimpanzees. So when that happens, nobody says that the New Caledonian crows are smarter than the chimpanzees. But the minute a chimpanzee does something that, say, a crow or another animal can't do, people don't hesitate to say, oh, look, the chimpanzees are smarter. You know, that's a form of speciesism. Okay. Yeah. So once again, with respect to self-consciousness or consciousness, it doesn't really matter whether their consciousness or their sense of self is like ours. They do what they need to do in order to be members of their species. And from a biological point of view, I think that that's a very important claim simply because we shouldn't use ourselves as the template against which, you know, all other animals are measured, because we don't use ultrasound or infrasound, while bats use ultrasound and elephants and whales and other cetaceans use infrasound. So, you know, I think those are really good examples that animals do what they need to do to be card-carrying members of their species, and it's not that they're better or worse or higher or lower. And I think you can apply the same argument to consciousness. It doesn't really matter if my dog Jethro's, when he was alive, his sense of consciousness wasn't as well developed. He had enough of dog consciousness to be a card-carrying dog.
Right, but that's not to say that his conscious experience of the world was the same as yours, or that he took the same meaning from the world that you I presumably take from it, right?
Right, right. And from the fact that he may not have, it didn't – right. I know I'm agreeing with you. So from
right.
The fact that he may take the same picture doesn't mean that he's not conscious. Right.
Right. Right. I agree.
Yeah.
Right.
So we're in total agreement because that's what really gets me upset when people go, well, dog joy or dog grief or, you know, chimpanzee grief, is it the same as ours? And I'm saying, number one, we don't know that. But number two, it doesn't matter if it is, because my grief and my joy and my – sense of self may be radically different from yours, but it doesn't mean that you have it and I don't, or vice versa.
Right.
And that's what I think is, and that's really coming out very clear now in the world, you know, that people are really learning, you know, like I said, that humans are not necessarily the template against which all other, you know, species are measured.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I think we have a problem with is there's this idea that we have to raise animals up as if we're higher than them. And so we try to, and I know it's well-meaning, but people will say a pig is as intelligent as a three-year-old child. And I don't know how you measure intelligence, but I have a three-year-old granddaughter, and I just wouldn't equate her intelligence to that of a pig. No, I mean, you know, not taking anything away from a pig, but they're just...
Right.
You know, they're just different animals, you know, and I don't know that helps us at all
It helps us. I don't think it helps us one bit, and I've published this a number of times. I think those comparisons that people make are often well motivated, but they're often motivated by getting research money, because if you can have some connection to the study of animal behavior and how it might inform us about human behavior, you know, you have more of a chance of getting a grant or something like that.
Yeah.
So when I hear that, you know, I mean, your example is a great one, you know, and when I hear that, you know, the, you know, 2.5-year-old children or, you know, are equivalent to, you know, an intelligence to, you know, an adult chimpanzee, it means nothing to me. Number one, there's a lot of variation among chimpanzees and 2-year-old or 3-year-old children. And number two, it doesn't mean anything to me. You know, analogous to that is when I give lectures, people will say, well, are cats smarter than dogs? And I always say, well, as a biologist, that's a meaningless question, because dogs do what they need to do to be dogs, and cats do what they need to do to be cats. And so to say one is more intelligent is really, it doesn't tell me anything. You can't have... You know, we can have levels of intelligence within species. You know, you might have dogs who are slow on the goat or learning detour learning. And you may say, well, Fido's not as smart as Pluto in detour learning, but Fido may be smarter than Pluto in, you know, finding hidden food. I mean, I guess what I'm getting into on this is, you know, that theory of multiple intelligences that Howard Gardner has written about, that you can have dogs display multiple intelligences too. And one of my friends is a veterinarian from Mexico and has worked in some very, very rough areas in Mexico, has populations of dogs that she calls street smart dogs. And she always tells me that none of the dogs I lived with in the past would survive a day among these dogs.
That's pretty funny. So I'm going to ask you one more question about this, and then we can move on to something else. So you wrote another article about how bears can count, And I don't – it was interesting, but what I want to note, and I think it's important, is that you put the word count in inverted commas, the people in Britain say. We'd call it quotation marks. But you put the word count in quotation marks. And I see that most of the time when a study that's done makes it into the popular press, the quotation marks get lost. You know, so you'll see a study about how cockroaches are gregarious. And you read the original study, and the word gregarious is always in quotation marks by the scientist, because he's using a word, and you've talked about this in some of the writing that you've done. He's using a word so that we can relate to what the behavior looks like. He's not using the word as if to ascribe mental states to cockroaches. And so do you think that's part of the same problem? I mean, we have to anthropomorphize in some way so that we can talk about these things, but mistakes get made that way, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And actually, as you know, I never use quotations around words that describe emotions. And I just wrote a blog. In fact, I just published a blog, on Psych Today, a few minutes before we started talking. And it's called "Did a Female Burrow Commit Suicide?" Because I heard this really compelling story this weekend. And I didn't put the word suicide in quotes. I put the word, and I don't put, joy in dogs or grief, in monkeys or great apes in quotes. I put count in quotes, and because there's evidence that animals have, what we call numerical competency. And the word that people who study this use is the word subitize. And what subitize means is that animals can scan a group and make assessments of more or less. And I actually studied this in anti-predatory behavior in birds, showing that the birds that I studied changed their behavior on whether there were, say, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8 birds around. I'm not saying that they're counting and in the same way we would count, but they're subitizing, and they know that a certain array of birds means, if you will, there's more birds than another array of birds. It's very clear that a lot of animals have this numerical competency, but they may not actually count like we do. And that's why I put that word in count in quotes. But the point I was trying to make is I don't use those scare quotes to when I write about animal emotions, because I always say that animals love one another, but humans might, quote, love one another, just to be, funny about it.
Yeah.
So, but no, it's a good, I mean, yes, I thought about it, I thought about it a lot. And then I decided that the evidence for animals counting in the same way we count is not very compelling. And I wouldn't want people to think that, birds or bears sit down and go 1, 2, 3. Or wolves now, there's an ongoing study that shows that wolves are very good at, subitizing and discriminating, among arrays on a computer screen of 3, 4, 5, up until 10 objects.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, it's phenomenal.
Yeah. What really fascinates me, and you touched on this earlier, is that I read it in the same journal where the article was published about the dog, about the bears counting. It wasn't a study. It was an essay written by a couple of fellows about insect navigation and what we learn from bees and ants navigating. And the gist of it is that complex behaviors like navigating back and forth to the hive can be explained using very simple mechanical behaviors that don't rely on any sort of higher cognition. And what these two authors theorize is that much of the navigation that we as humans do is probably explainable in the same way. So what you were saying earlier about how much of the behavior that human beings engage in that is really operating on a very sort of basic level. We like to think of ourselves as being these really smart animals that are running around, but we may be doing a lot of the same behaviors that even bees are doing. So I think that's really fascinating.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that's a really important point, once again, not to pull humans down as a way to elevate animals, non-human animals, but it's just that so much of what we do is rote or reflex-like or can be explained by, you know, these really, some are sophisticated, but, you know, models. So I think that kind of discussion really convinces people, you know, who are skeptics that we're not so special as we make ourselves, and animals aren't as dumb as we sometimes make them out to be.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Mark, I'd like to read something you said in a Forbes interview in May this year and then ask you a couple of questions about it, if you don't mind.
Well, I might. You'll have to ask.
Okay. What you said was, while I work hard to protect animals of all stripes, shapes, and sizes, I prefer to say that I'm interested in animal protection rather than animal rights, because the phrase animal rights turns so many people off, mainly because they don't understand what it means. It often serves as a conversation stopper and then the door's closed for further useful dialogue. Nonetheless, I would like to see animals get legal and moral rights in the future, and I'm thrilled there are a number of highly motivated and bright people working on their behalf. End quote. My first question to you about that is, when you say that talk about animal rights is a conversation stopper, do you mean that because people don't understand the concept or the philosophy of animal rights that conversation is stopped? Or is it more because people have preconceived ideas about how animal rights advocates are radical and kind of out there?
Oh, I think it's both, but I think my experience is more that people have a very confused notion of what it means to grant a right to a living being, and they worry that, you know, if animals get rights, what about human rights? So to me, and yeah, that's basically it. But then there are some people, you know, who have that confused notion too, that, you know, people who work on animal rights are radical hippie nutballs. And what's really interesting, because the town in which I gave these talks this weekend is a small mountain town. There's lots of ranching and farming around. And one of the guys there, and there's some, you know, it's like a lot of small towns around the world, I'm sure, or maybe around America and probably other countries, where very educated people, some retirees, some, you know, people who just don't get jobs, and they're very, very smart, and they just like living in small towns. So this one guy made a comment to me about animal rights and PETA after I made a comment that I wish that people would reflect on who they eat rather than what they eat, because so many of the animals who humans eat are sentient beings, and they're who's, not what. So he just started making some comments about, you know, that he was sick and tired of all the animal rights people who are so violent and blah, 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 blah. And I asked him, you know, if he could tell me more. And, you know, it turned out that, you know, he was really just thinking about a very small handful of people. And that's why he was turned off by the animal rights movement. There was a lawyer in the audience who came up and talked to me afterwards and made the same comment as, you know, sort of as part of your question, saying that, you know, this guy was so terribly confused about what it meant to grant a chimpanzee or a dolphin or a dog a right.
I agree with you. I think people like yourself and Tom Regan, Will Tuttle, people like that who are out there and the public see regularly, who represent animal rights or animal advocates in such a positive way, I think that we all owe people like you guys a debt. So thank you for that.
No, you're nice. I just want to be able to have a conversation with people, and I'd rather talk to the unconverted, if you will, because that's where we're going to make changes, and I don't want to turn them off. I think part of what we need to do, you know, to change minds and hearts, heads and hearts, is we got to talk with people with whom we disagree and show them that we're not the bad guys, or we're, you know, I always say we're not the radicals. It's the people who are destroying animals and their habitats who are the, who should be called the radicals.
Exactly. One more question I had about your quote. You say that you'd like to see other animals get moral and legal rights, and that you're thrilled lots of people are working on that. Do you see yourself as working for the rights of other animals as well? And whether you do or not, do you think that there's something else people need to work for in addition to those rights? Like, is there something that we need to change before animals can actually be granted rights?
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess I see myself, you know, it's the work I do that if I see the work I do that it can be used to make arguments that, you know, animals should be granted rights. But I'm not one of the people, you know, the people I think about, you know, for example, might be the lawyer Stephen Wise, who, you know, has spent the better part of his life trying to get rights for great apes, or people who wrote in the, you know, the book The Great Ape Project. But I find myself being contacted by lots of organizations, from lawyers to business people to just, you know, I give talks in churches and in synagogues by people who are really interested in animal emotions and animal moral behavior and animal cognition. And I always weave in the message that these are certain traits of animals can be used in arguments to grant them rights. As far as I know, people use, you know, the work that I do and others do to make arguments for granting animals legal rights.
Fantastic. Mark, I'd like to thank you so much for being our guest today. It's been an absolute pleasure to be speaking with you and to hear your amazing insights. It's been fantastic. But before we say goodbye, is there anything you'd like to say to our listeners that we haven't covered yet?
We talked about, we mentioned rewilding, and all I'll say about the rewilding project is it's an extension of these rewilding projects that are taking place all over the world where animal habitats are being protected and corridors are being, you know, protected or made, underpasses and overpasses, so that animals can walk around freely. And the rewilding project, to me, basically, and the rewilding our hearts is metaphorically to get animals and their lives to course through the corridors in our bodies and our hearts and our brains. I mean, that's, you know, I wrote an article for Psychology Today where I was, you know, writing about that. The other thing I've been writing a lot about is the compassion footprint, which is all part of, you know, the rewilding project. But my major message in terms of bringing about change for non-human animal beings is that those who are working for animal rights or animal welfare or in compassionate conservation or whatever field, we need to make a united front, and we need to stop bickering with one another. And people argue with me about that, but if we don't present a united front, the animals are going to lose. I have people say to me, look, you know, I see these arguments with people. Well, why don't you just come back to me and talk to me when you guys get back together, or, you know. So I really mean this. I don't mean this in any fluffy way. And if I disagree with you or you disagree with me, that's just fine.
Yep.
You just stop bickering, present a united front, and animals will benefit. So I always say we need to work for the animals, not against other people. We need to work for a particular position, and while we're working for a position, we're kind of implicitly working against another position. But for the guy, I'm an optimist, and I run out of steam at the end of the day. And one way I'm going to run out of steam is I'm going to stop getting involved in arguments with people, because those arguments are simply deflections of time and energy that I could be putting into improving the lives of non-human animals.
I couldn't agree with you more, absolutely. I think it's about respecting each other as well. We can, like you said, we can disagree with each other as much as we like. I mean, that's just part of being human, disagreeing with other humans. But there's no reason that we shouldn't be able to respect each other. A friend of mine, Greg McFarlane, has a quote that I adore at the moment, and it just says, veganism is not about vegans, and it's not.
Yeah, that's a wonderful quote. The compassionate conservation movement is wonderful too. Being about compassionate conservation is not only for the animals, it's for the people too, because it's easy for us people who are privileged and have money and do all these things to tell people in poor countries what to do. And I travel a lot, and I can't impose my good old white American standards on what the work I do in China or the people working in India. And so that's why if we concentrate on being for the animals, we can transcend cultures, we can transcend differences, and we can practice the compassion that we want the world to be. This compassion begets compassion idea means it crosses species lines. So I don't mean to deliver a sermon here, but I just had it with going to meetings where people just start screaming at other people who have devoted their lives to working for animals.
Look, I couldn't agree with you more, absolutely. Thank you again, Mark, for joining us today. We sincerely appreciate your visit to AR Zone and everything that you do for both humans and other animals. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good eve. I'm going to bolt out of here.
Thank you for listening to AR Zone. Please visit us online at www.arzone.net and look for us on iTunes.